Tango Tango Papa 1689, October 9th, 2012.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from San Antonio, Texas. So I came back to work Saturday. Had to think there for a second. Was home for time off, and I came back to work on Saturday. And so I picked a load up in Russellville. I believe I picked a load up in Russellville. I don't know. Anyway, I picked a load up. I think it was in Russellville, I'm pretty sure. And then it went to... where did it go to? Alabama. It went to Pelham, Alabama. Russellville. No, I stopped and got fuel in Russellville. The load picked up in Carthage, Missouri. Jeez. Alzheimer's. The load picked up in Carthage, Missouri, and then that, so I was able to pick that up, and then I spent Saturday, since I was going right by home, spent Saturday night at home, and then got up Sunday and drove down to Pelham, Alabama, and then the load delivered there. That's a suburb of Birmingham, essentially. That delivered early Monday morning, and then finally, I've got a friend, Victor, that lives, I guess, in the Birmingham area somewhere. And all these years, he's been listening to my podcast, and it's just never worked out to where we could meet each other. And so finally, I've got to spend some time together. I got the load unloaded, there was a kind of a place where I could park the truck. Actually, where I spent the night at, near the place where I unloaded at. And so he came a little later in the morning after the load was unloaded. He came and took me to Boy, my memory is gone. I can see the place. It's Cracker Barrel. I could almost see the sign in my mind. Cracker Barrel. I never have eaten in Cracker Barrel for breakfast, but the food's always good. I've never had a bad meal at Cracker Barrel. And so he bought my breakfast, and we got to kind of hang out a little bit and chit-chat and finally meet in person. So that was good. That's always great to be able to spend time with people, especially after you've kind of... you know, of course, over the years, we've exchanged emails, and we've even talked on the phone a time or two, and of course, we end up playing this Words with Friends. Been playing that for quite some time, and so it's good to finally get to meet in person. So anyway, after that, he took me back to the truck, and then had to go up to Decatur, Alabama, and then I picked up the load. That was yesterday, so yesterday being Monday. I picked that up yesterday afternoon, and then pretty much after I got the load picked up, I left Decatur and then drove about as far as I could. Got down into Mississippi along Interstate 59, and found a place to park, and so that's where I spent the night at last night. And at that point, I had I was down to like 580 miles roughly to get here to San Antonio, which is easily doable in one day. And so made it here, I guess it was 9:15 central time this evening when I made it here to San Antonio. And then so I'm parked in a truck stop, and then the load delivers in San Antonio. I think it, according to my directions, near downtown San Antonio. So don't know if they had, if the place had truck parking or not. I'm assuming since it's downtown, it might probably wasn't any overnight parking, and don't know what the neighborhood's like or anything else. So I because I got here by 9:15, was able to kind of stop the logbook clock. So I can take probably about a, altogether maybe an 11 or 12 hour break here at this truck stop on the west side of San Antonio. And then I think downtown San Antonio, according to the GPS, I'm about 14 miles from where the load actually delivers. So right now I'm out on the edge of the city. So anyway, that delivers tomorrow at 10 a.m. So I'll leave here, leave this truck stop, and kind of time it so that I get there approximately an hour, maybe by 9 o'clock or a little bit after. And then, that'd be about an hour or so before the appointment time. The appointment time's at 10 a.m. And then we'll see where, you know, where they send me after that. There's a good chance I'll be going to Austin. There seems to be a lot of loads that come out of Austin. There's a place where we pick up a lot of loads out of, and so there's a, at least a good chance that I can, you know, the next load will go from Austin to either Philadelphia or somewhere in Massachusetts. But don't really know until then. So anyway, it's been cooler the past couple of days. It's been, you know, even down into Alabama. It was, I think yesterday there in Alabama, the highest temperature I saw on the phone, you know, on the weather widget on my phone, I think it was either 57 or 59 degrees, and a little warmer today, but not by a whole lot. And then, you know, it might have hit 70 as I was kind of, you know, probably in between Houston and San Antonio. I don't know. I never really checked it then. But now right now I've got the air conditioner, the battery operated air conditioner here running in the truck. Even though it's cool enough outside, I roll the windows up to kind of keep out the noise, and if there's any flies out there, I doubt if there are, but there might be. So I rolled the windows up, and it was a little stuffy in here, so I went ahead and turned the air conditioner on. Sometimes that'll happen because you just have some heat, I guess, that's probably possibly still from the engine or whatever, but you can get some, and there's residual heat, not only in the seats, but the, you know, this bunk and what have you. There's some heat in there, and so it'll, once it, I don't know what the overnight low is supposed to be here, but once it probably cools down overnight, I can probably shut the air conditioner off and be just fine. Now, last night there, where I was parked in this parking area along Interstate 59 in Mississippi, it, was down in the, 50s, and I pretty much was able to just sleep without having any heat, or even though, you know, it was in the 50s, but I was able to sleep without having any heat turned on. They have this battery operated or fuel fired heater actually for the bunk back here when the main motor's turned off. So I was able to sleep, you know, I have the sleeping bag, and then I've also got a lighter blanket. Now, the sleeping bag is not very heavy. It's not rated for very heavy because you don't really want that, but I just use it as a blanket. But if I need a lighter blanket, then I do have one that's even lighter than that, just a regular kind of a, I don't know what kind of material that is, some sort of synthetic material blanket, and it's kind of lighter, and so it's, you know, if it's not that cool, then I'll use that blanket so that I, you know, because I hate waking up in the middle of the night sweating. That's that's not good when that happens. So I think I mentioned in the last podcast I recorded at home from the phone that I had called Verizon with the intent of canceling the old Alltel USB air card, you know, that ended up switching to Verizon after Verizon bought it. The intent of canceling it because I figured I could just do without it and just use my Sprint phone, because I'm using that as a podcast aggregator anyway now. And they ended up offering me the a MiFi device, a 4G Verizon MiFi device with unlimited data for the same price, $60 a month. And I've been paying $60 a month for a number of years now, ever since I got that Alltel USB air card. So, and there was no charge for the device. Of course, I had to sign a 2-year contract. And they waived the activation fee. So basically, I just got a new device that's unlimited, that has better performance, like way better performance. The 4G is amazing. Way better performance for the same price. And so I just have to keep it for 2 years, which I will, obviously. So then I went ahead and canceled the hotspot feature off of my phone. So I still have the unlimited talk, unlimited data for the phone itself, unlimited text messages, Simply Everything plan from Sprint. Still have that, but got rid of the hotspot feature because I really obviously don't need it, because I got this 4G Verizon hotspot. Now, at my house, so when I first plugged it in, I got it on Friday, the day before I went back to work. At my house, when I first plugged it in, it was just 3G because it changes. It's got kind of a sort of a purple flashing LED when it's connected to 3G, and then when it switches to 4G, it's a green flashing LED. So initially, when I plug it in, and I did it a couple of times, plug it in at my house. I had it sitting on my bar there in my house, and it was initially flashing the purple LED. But then after it sits there for a while, it changed to green, and indicating that it's 4G, and it seems to stay on the 4G, but if I move that thing at all, it'll switch back to 3G. So it seems to prefer the 4G, but it, at least right there at my house, it'll switch. So, but in any case, while it was on the 4G, after I picked that load up at Carthage, Missouri, and went back home, I ended up watching a couple of things on Netflix. There's one thing I want to talk about here in a second. There's a show on Netflix called Lilyhammer. But in any case, the Verizon 4G is just wickedly fast. And so I was able to actually stream HD. HD was coming from Netflix, and you could actually see it in the picture. It's really quite a good picture. So in any case, that actually worked. So I watched a couple of things on there before I ended up going to bed. So a friend had told me about this. There's a show on Netflix, and if you've never heard of it, it's called Lilyhammer, as in Lilyhammer, Norway. So Lilyhammer is the name of the city in Norway, and I think they had Olympics back in the 90s at some point. And so that's kind of its claim to fame, at least in the last 10 to 15 years, 20 or so. So in any case, it's a show, it's a series actually, and they've got the first season on there. The first season's like 8 episodes, and they have yet to make any additional episodes, but it was made between Netflix and in conjunction with a television network in Norway, and it was sort of made for Netflix and made for Norwegian television. And so it does have some subtitles. It's partially in English and partially in Norwegian, and so they, you know, whenever they, you know, someone's speaking Norwegian, and they kind of throw the subtitles up there. So it's about half and half, and so it's very easy to follow and easy to watch. So, but you don't want to watch it while you're while you're sleeping. You know, I've found that a lot of movies, you know, let's say it's a documentary or whatever, and then they're interviewing, or in a lot of movies they like to, instead of having a narrator read something, they'll throw text up on the screen, and that doesn't really work very well if you're in bed. You know, and you just kind of, maybe you close your eyes and you're listening to the sound part of the time. Or if you're, you know, you have the TV, depending on how you have your television placed, if you're kind of looking at it from the side, you know, it's kind of hard, makes it really difficult to try to read the subtitles. You know, if you're laying on your side and you're looking at the TV sideways, essentially. So anyway, this is a drama series, and it's kind of funny as well. But it's about this. So I watched the first episode, and I haven't watched any sub. You know, there's seven more episodes that I can watch as of right now. So, but I watched the first one, and it's pretty good. Really enjoyed it. It's about this. The premise of it is that there's this gangster from New York City, and he gets put into this witness protection program because he testifies against his boss, and so it's his choice to go to Lillehammer, Norway. So they come up with this cover story about his father was from Norway, and so he's moving to Norway or whatever, and so that's the premise of it. And then so the show kind of consists, at least this first episode, of him sort of clashing with the Norwegian culture. And, you know, so it's really quirky. You know, he's quirky, and the other characters in the show are quirky too. So if you ever watched the, there's nothing in common. But if you've ever watched there was a show on HBO called Dead Like Me. It was a series. It's kind of in that vein, you know, where you have these quirky characters. And so even though there's nothing in common plot-wise, you kind of have the quirky characters. And so that's sort of the way the characters are in this, and of course the scenery. It was actually filmed on location in Norway, and so the scenery is just spectacular, and it's really well. Whoever produced it, it's really extremely well produced. So very, you know, really looks good. Great series. So I'm looking forward to watching more of those episodes. But that's on your net. If you got a Netflix account, that's on there. Just look up, do a search, and it's Lillehammer, and it'll show up. But that was commissioned by Netflix in conjunction with this Norwegian television network. And so I've got this friend. The friend that told me about it, his mother is Norwegian, and even though he's American, you know, he actually lived for a time in Norway, and he's telling me that the Norwegian, that they're really accurately depicting the Norwegian culture. So it's different. But it's pretty interesting. So really, really enjoyed that. And as I say, I'm looking forward to watching more of those. So, I think when I recorded the last podcast on the phone, that was after the debate with the first presidential debate. And since then, it's pretty widely acknowledged that Romney won the debate and that Obama, you know, kind of didn't perform very well. You know, and depending on who you're listening to, they're coming up with various excuses. Well, Romney lied. He changed his position, and Obama wasn't prepared to deal with it. That's nonsense. What happened? I'll tell you what happened. It's very, very simple, but it's worth understanding. It's absolutely worth understanding. What happened? Obama had this story that he was going to tell about Romney's going to cut taxes by $5 trillion and, you know, give this big tax break to all these rich buddies and blah, blah, blah. And Romney, Obama said that, and then Romney interrupted him and said, that's not true, and he proceeded to explain, but he did it without any animosity. Romney didn't, there was no animosity, even when he essentially called Obama a liar, although he didn't use that word, but he did actually a couple of times where he said it in another, with using other words, but he basically said that Obama was lying, but he did it with no animosity at all. He did it, you know, he smiled, he was firm, but he did it without any animosity. So Obama said, repeated the same thing again, and Romney immediately refuted it again. And then Obama did it a third time. He said, repeated the same lie, and then Romney refuted it a third time. And then after that, Obama sort of froze up, because he's kind of like the little kid with his hand in the cookie jar, and, you know, getting caught with your hand in the cookie jar, and then you say, I didn't do that, my hand wasn't in the cookie jar. Oh yes, it was. And so that's essentially what happened. Now, normally, if you know, the tactic of lying about somebody only works if they can get you, if someone lie, let's say someone tells a lie about you, and even lies to your face and tells the lie right in front of you, like at that debate. If you get upset, you've lost. I know it's tempting, and you think it's some sort of defense to have resentment, and you think you can turn your damn resentment into something positive. I'm telling you, you can't, and you're a fool if you think you can. And so that's that. At that debate, this first debate between Romney and Obama, is about as good as an example I can give you of someone standing up without resentment. And in the form of Mitt Romney, he stood up to Obama without any resentment whatsoever, and Obama was not prepared, just totally unprepared to deal with it, because he's never had to deal with anything like that. The serpent's mind freezes up in that situation, and that's basically what possesses Obama. He's got the snake-like mind that may be clever, but it freezes when someone is able to stand up to it without resentment. And then you could see who was lying. You could see where the problem was. You could see where the evil was. And so, you know, initially I wasn't even going to watch that debate, because I knew Obama was going to be lying, and and that's nothing new. Every word out of the guy's mouth is pretty much a lie, and it just grates on me. And there's a lot of other people it grates on as well, and so I wasn't really going to watch it. And then I thought, well, you know, it was about 2 or 3 hours after the debate, and I happened to remember, oh, there was a debate. I bet I can go on the Blaze website, the Glenn Beck website, or actually it was on the Roku box, the Blaze TV network on the Roku box, and I was able. They had the recording of it, and I watched it. And then they had a 30-minute thing afterwards, sort of analyzing it. And I was pleasantly surprised. So I will watch any debate with Mitt Romney in it, because Mitt Romney, it was brilliant. Because he's able to, there's been this perception, Shell, that the media has sort of created, and, you know, sort of put, you know, they weave this cocoon about Romney, and he's wimpy, and he's this mushy Republican that gives in to his you know, your political enemies. He just gives in, and he's a politician, and he's this mushy Republican, and sort of a rhino type guy. And that's what they've deliberately created, that impression. And so this is the first time we've actually seen Romney. Now, I don't know. I guess there was a debate 4 years ago. I really didn't pay that much attention, you know, whenever they were, you know, they have the six guys or whatever. Of course, Romney didn't end up being the nominee last time. So Romney, this is the first time that he's, you know, that we've seen him in a presidential type debate where he's debating directly. Now, it might be worth searching YouTube and find out if, you know, if there's gubernatorial debates when he was running for governor of Massachusetts and what other media there is out there. But in this case, you had Romney just shining brilliantly. And it was because he's able to articulate the truth, but he's doing it with no animosity whatsoever. And if you can tell someone you're lying and you can call them on it without resenting them, that's it, they may repeat it and they'll try harder. They may try harder, but it causes them to freeze up. So any future debates, the two upcoming debates are worth watching. I think there are two more presidential debates. They're worth watching. Who cares about Obama? We know he lies. But I want to see Mitt Romney. Because I actually, you know, and Romney has such a wonderful command of the facts. You watch that and you actually learn something from it. You know, and this stupid idea, well, sparks should fly. No, they shouldn't. You don't need to have sparks flying. That's just a distraction. You know, where, you know, you have someone calling someone else or, calling them a name or that type of thing, you know, where they're, you know, someone puts somebody else down, essentially. You don't need that. All you need to be able to do is tell them you're lying. That's not true. And here's the truth. And without any animosity present. And that's what has to happen. See, that you should be able to discipline your kids. If you got kids, that's the way you should be able to discipline them. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't be firm with them. You should be firm with them. But do it without animosity, because a little kid, all the little kid sees, if, you know, a typical example would be in the supermarket checkout line. I've seen it happen a million times where the parent, the kid wants, yeah, I want this, and he's trying to grab something, and then the parent, you can... disciplines the kid, but they do it with, there's animosity present in the parent. And of course, all the kid sees is the animosity. And they're not able to, they want discipline. That's why they, you know, little kids want to be disciplined. They want to know where the limits are. They like to test those limits. But they don't want, you know, they don't really want the animosity. But that's all they see. They end up, the animosity ends up causing, making them feel justified, kind of hating their parents because they see animosity. That's all they see. And they know that the animosity is wrong. They know that the resentment on the parent, you know, is wrong. That, you know, the parent should be able to discipline them without any animosity. The same way that, you know, God disciplines human beings. You know, God doesn't have any animosity when he disciplines us. So we should be able to do the same thing. So in any case, that's a really good example. And it was brilliant. And it wasn't anything that, you know, Romney wasn't just having a good night or... Obama, you know, Al Gore even said that well, you know, Obama wasn't used to the altitude, the 5,000 feet altitude. Nah, that's ridiculous. How did he get there? You know, he got there in Air Force One. Well, did they fly at 5,000 feet? No, they were higher than that, probably 8,000. You know, that's, I think the typical jet, if it flies at 30,000 feet, the atmosphere, the pressure that they maintain is about 8,000, which is 3,000 feet higher than Denver. What's Denver's, 5,280 feet, a mile high, or at least part of it is. So, you know, they come up with all kinds of excuses. So it's going to be interesting to watch. But nonetheless, I think I'm optimistic. I think, you know, I may be all wet, I may be all wrong. I think Romney wins the election. And I think he's going to be a really good example. There's going to be people that are going to howl. If you thought they hated Ronald Reagan, you ain't seen nothing yet. Because in the meantime, since Reagan, people have continued, the people that are deteriorating, they're on the path to moral deterioration. They've continued to deteriorate. They've continued to get worse. And Mitt Romney is easily on the order of Ronald Reagan, you know, that type of person. And Mitt Romney has he's got a sterling character. Puts the rest of us to shame. And you put a guy like that in the spotlight of being president, and those people that are morally decrepit, their brains are going to fry. Their brains are just literally going to fry. And they actually need to. Now, some of the people are kind of caught in the middle, and they're sort of on that path, but they're redeemable. And so, you know, and then you have people that are, those people are also suggestible, and they'll begin to emulate they'll emulate the president. So if you put a good guy in there, they'll start to emulate him. And that's actually a good thing. But I want the truth. Even if the truth is painful, even if the truth hurts, I want the truth. The truth is always, even if it seems negative or it seems painful, the truth is always a positive thing. And a lie, you know, you tell someone, you know, little white lies or what, a lie is always destructive. And that's especially true, you know, in major matters, you know, with like a politician. Politicians should just, you know, I want the truth. And the truth is, as far as the country goes, that we've just spent money like a drunken sailor. We've printed money. We've allowed our morals to go into the sewer. Far too many of us. Our morals have gone into the sewer. And we need to be told that. We need to face that. Here's the way it is. No animosity. Here's the problem. Here's the truth. And here's what the principle we're going to have to get on in order to fix it. I want the truth. I don't, you know, if I go to the doctor and the doctor, you know, and the doctor finds some horrible disease, and, you know, there's a chance that I might drop dead or the disease is going to kill me. Tell me the truth. I want to know the truth. Chances are I'll probably guess it anyway before I ever go to the doctor. But I want to know the truth. I don't want somebody lying to me and telling, oh, well, everything's fine. Here, dearie, here, have your pill. Everything's fine. Just take your pill and you'll feel better. I want the truth. And I think a lot of people want the truth. I would much rather have the truth than some lie. But my mom and my dad, especially mom, is a, you know, she's liberal. And I was talking to her on the phone today. This is the first time I've actually talked to her since the debate, or before the debate. But anyway, you know, she started in, well, Romney lied, and so on and so forth. Or she said they both lied. And I said, well, just, I don't care. I don't care how you see it. You know, forget about that. Forget about it. You can try hating politicians all you want. It's detrimental. It's actually you resent anything. It's a sin. Sorry, but that's a sin. Can't do that. Don't want to do that. You have to look at it in terms of principle. Our morals have gone into the sewer. Then we end up with the government we deserve as a result. And you can try changing leaders all day long, and that's not going to fix it. In order to really change it, we've got to change our morals. You know, and then the other thing, I basically told her, you know, I'm not, you know, I and my two younger brothers, we're not going to let our parents starve. You know, and I guess she'd forgotten, but, you know, I actually bought, you know, a couple of years ago, I actually bought the storable food. And so, you know, and I told her, and then after I told her, then she kind of got reminded of that. And I said, I'm not going to let you, you're not going to starve. You're not going to starve. I'm not going to let you starve. So, but just be prepared. Romney's going to win. And I think we've been granted a stay of execution, at least for a while, as a nation. So things can, at least for a time, things can turn around. And things really could turn around. If we turn our morals around, things would turn around. Maybe that's happening. Maybe it will happen. Don't, you know, it's really kind of hard to say at this point. But I think some people are kind of paying attention now, but that weren't before. But we have to, we've got a long way to go. You know, if nothing else, you know, people have been saying, well, we're going to pay a price for the, you know, the abortion thing. You know, the 50 million, I guess it's up to 50 million now. Children have been murdered in their womb. Well, is that a nation? You know, there's this idea, and I guess it's because of the language in the Bible that nations are punished. But what it comes down to, if let's say I murder my kid, and that's really what we're talking about. Let's say I murder my kid. Kid's just too much. I don't want to have to feed him, and it's don't want to have to face a responsibility. It's going to be inconvenient for me. I just want to murder my kid. Well, it's bad for the kid, but it's bad for me, and it's bad for the people that are left living, because then, you know, you murder your kid, then what do you got to do? Well, then you've got to go through all kinds of machinations and you know, wrong is right, right is wrong. You have to end up twisting things, finding people that'll lie with you, that help you, you know, agree that right is wrong and wrong is right. It's really okay to kill your kid. They're inconvenient. Go ahead and just do away with them. They're unwanted. Just do away with them. Kill them. Find someone that agrees with you, a group of people. Have marches. March down the street. Have a kill your kid parade. Is that thing going to stop? Let me fix this. It's driving me insane. I know what it is. There it is. Right there. Stop.
quit.
Okay, I gotta put in the password. There. I don't know what that is, if it's part of OS 10, but it does that, and it's insane. So, but it causes the CPU to go up to 100%, and then that causes a stupid inverter to start protesting. So, but, you know, you just imagine that you kill your kid, and then you have to try to run away from your conscience. And you employ other people, and you end up turning wrong side out in order to, and living your life upside down in order to try to evade that conscience. And you end up embracing a kind of a death, creating a death-centered culture. But it's bad for you as an individual. Very bad. And then, of course, you have to try to force the people around you to see that it's really okay to kill your kid. That's really a, it's just a tissue mass. It's just an unviable tissue mass. Easily gotten rid of. So that's not so much the nation, it's under the banner of the flag that you're, you know, murdering or whatever. The real problem revolves around, you know, at the small level, at the micro level, it revolves around your character and what that does to your character when you won't face that guilty conscience. And of course, you murder your kid, you can have a conscience like you can't believe. And you deserve it, by the way, too. So that's happened 50 million times since 1973. 50 million times. So that's at least 100 million parents. 100 million parents have killed their children. Stop and think about that. Now, what are those 100 million people have to do? They have to believe that wrong is right and right is wrong. And you can't do it in just one thing. You can't just say, well, I'm moral in every other way, but this one way. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. You end up embracing the spirit of evil, everything that's rotten, you embrace it. Whether you realize it or not. Of course, you twist things in your mind, you know, so that you think you're a good person. And then you get the people around you to sort of agree with you and help you maintain that illusion. But you're really rotten. 100 million parents. 100 million parents and counting. And that's just one issue. What about all the kids? Over 50% of kids overall are born outside of marriage, and a good chunk of those don't even know who the dad is. What kind of slime ball people would do that to you, to their children? Probably the same type that would murder them. Now, those people not only deserve to suffer, but their suffering is actually a blessing. I know people, you know, we have this tendency, we want to run away from it, and we think we're being punished or whatever, punished somehow. If you have to suffer, you're being punished. You're actually being blessed, because suffering, if you meet suffering properly, if you're able to meet it properly, deal with it properly, it's a blessing. Now, I'm not suggesting, there's this knee-jerk reaction, and you think, oh, I should run out and, stick myself with needles so that I suffer. No. What is suffering, really? We have this idea, you know, that we've got this idea that everything should go our way, and, whatever our ego thinks, that's the way our life should go. And if anything goes arbitrary to that, then we're unjustly suffering. And so suffering is painful. Obviously, to the extent that you resent it. And of course, our egos resent it. Because it didn't go our way. We didn't get the new car. We're not rich. Or whatever it is. You know, people are pissed off oftentimes because they're not born into wealth. They think they got the raw deal. But suffering, if you handle it the right way, if you deal with it the right way, with the right attitude, it's a blessing, because it the pain of that can cause you to wake up. We're not here. Why are we here? Why my belief is, the reason why we're here is not to have cushy lives and pleasure ourselves to death and so on and so forth. That's not why we're here. If that's why you're here, what a shallow, wasteful existence that is. We're here to awaken to our Creator. We're here as human beings to become conscious of our Creator. And I know those words, you hear those words, and it sounds, depending on your point of view, it may sound flat. You think, oh, it's just words. And I've heard those words 1,000 times. Meaningless. But I can't tell you, in the past couple of years, I've mentioned this before, in the past couple of years or so, it sort of snuck up on me. I realized that I had a peace of mind. I have this peace of mind, and it doesn't really make any sense. It sort of snuck up on me. It wasn't something that I did. I realized one day that it was there. And accompanying this peace of mind, I know beyond any shadow of a doubt there's a Creator. It's not really a matter of belief. You know, you can say, well, of course I believe, but I know. Without knowing how I know, I just know. But I have this peace of mind that it doesn't make any sense. And that's not to say that I'm perfect or the world around me is perfect. It's not. It's not. But the thing you know, I hate to, you know, the thing that, how to express that, nothing, regardless of what happens to me, or what happens, nothing can penetrate nothing can get in between me, whatever I am, and my Creator. Nothing can violate that. And nothing, actually nothing will violate that, because the, what is the point? Creator created us. The Creator created us for this relationship. So here we are. God created, also created evil, and he uses, you know, he uses these different forces to kind of get the experimental, you know, he's getting the results that he wants. You know, so you apply this process and you apply that, a little bit of this and a little bit of that process, and then you end up with the results that you want. And so God uses both good and evil to kind of refine us as human beings into what he wants from us. So therefore, I know that regardless of what happens, it's really impossible to put into words, but I know that in the end, it's all good. So that doesn't mean that I might complain about this or complain about that. Usually I don't. And overall, I have to say my life goes pretty well. My existence isn't perfect. I'm not perfect. But overall, things go pretty well. And sometimes they don't. But, you know, that's that. I'm not gonna... whine and moan and groan about it. But again, I have this peace of mind that just, it really kind of doesn't make any sense. You know, from an intellectual standpoint, you know, sort of an outside looking in standpoint, the peace of mind that I have is completely illogical. It doesn't make any sense. And I can't really put it into words very well. But I know beyond any shadow of a doubt that there is a Creator. You know, and it would be, you know, my wish is that everyone would be able to find this relationship, to have this peace of mind. But in order to have it, you've got to really want it. It's not something that's just going to fall in your lap, or you're going to just be able to say a few words and it's, you know, and it's going to magically happen. It doesn't work that way. I'm sorry. You've got to want it. In order to find your Creator and find the purpose of your existence, you've got to really want to find that purpose. So, but anyway, I would be prepared to, you know, things are going to get a little rough, I think. Maybe a lot rough, and they already have for a lot of people. But I think things are probably going to get worse. Because, you know, right now they're printing money like crazy. You know, this so-called quantitative easing number 3. They're printing money in hopes that they can keep things together long enough until Obama gets reelected. And that's not going to happen. So after the election, sometime after the election, I think things are really going to fall apart. I think the real unemployment rate's probably 24%. It's probably at least a quarter, one out of every four people that you see is probably unemployed or on the government dole somehow. So I think things are going to get rough, and the only way we're really going to improve things is to get more people working. You know, the concept, if you can just understand that the only reason we have all the things we have the cars and the TV sets and the cell phones and electricity and this and that. The only reason we have those things is because people work to produce them. People work to produce and maintain those things. And that's why we have them. And the more people that are working and producing those things, the more likely it is that we can all afford to have them. And so if we didn't have a currency, it would be a barter system. So, you know, I would do a certain amount of work and trade that work for the fruits of someone else's labor. So I'd trade the fruits of my labor for the fruits of someone else's labor. So then you create a currency system. And then it makes it really easy. It's a credit system. Then you're able to, you know, exchange your labor for a certain amount of credits, and then you can take those credits and exchange it for a certain amount of someone else's labor, the results of their labor. So we've got all of this labor, people producing goods and services. The more people that you have actually producing goods and services that are really productive and they're producing stuff, the easier life becomes for everyone. The better it becomes. The more enriched it becomes. But if you have a system that systematically ends up dysfunctionalizing people, robbing them of their incentive to produce goods and services, which ultimately help you're actually helping your fellow human beings when you work and you're producing things. You have that dysfunctional system and fewer people actually doing anything. At some point, it just all falls apart and it becomes, basically, it starts turning into hell on earth. So, what we need to have happen is people are re-incentivized to produce, get out there and produce goods and services. And then things will get better. But you can't simply print money. I think people don't have a real good concept of where money, what they think money is. Or where it comes from, they think the government just prints it and then it just magically has value. That doesn't work that way. It has no value unless people are working to produce goods and services. You know, imagine that you're the last, you know, like the Twilight Zone episode, you're the only person left on Earth. Well, you could have a whole, you know, Fort Knox stack of gold, if there is gold in Fort Knox. I don't know if there is anymore or not, but you could have a whole pile of gold, and if you were the only person alive, what good would it be? It would be totally worthless. The only reason it would have gold has worth now is because there are people working producing goods and services. So therefore it has value. That's the only reason that anything has value in the economy, is because people are actually working. So we need to get more people working. Very simple. It's not hard to understand. If you can get the right concepts in your head, it's not hard to understand at all. But we're going to go through a time where it's going to be tough. And so, you know, might be a good idea to have some food stored. And regardless of what happens, the best thing you can do is meet it without resentment. Whatever you have to suffer, suffer it. But don't do it. If you do it with resentment, that's the biggest mistake you can make. Because it you don't learn the lesson. And then you end up, you kind of like the people, you know, someone kills their kid. Then, you know, let's say you resent, you think you can turn resentment into something, you know, negative into positive. Or you'll say, oh, it's normal, and you'll find other people that agree with you. Go to the bar and find other people that really, it's okay, everybody resents. It's okay. It's normal. Wrong is right, right is wrong. You become worse. Find your slimy friends to help you become worse, and you help them become worse. Time to face reality. Time to grow up. Time to mature. Quit being a little baby. Time for people to quit acting like they're 5 years old from a maturity standpoint. So, anyway, probably better be cutting this off. Hope everyone is having a great week, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.
If I wanted America to fail, to follow, not lead, to suffer, not prosper, to despair, not dream, I'd start with energy. I'd cut off America's supply of cheap, abundant energy. I couldn't take it by force. So I'd make Americans feel guilty about using the energy that heats their homes, fuels their cars, runs their businesses, and powers their economy. I'd make cheap energy expensive, so that expensive energy would seem cheap. I would empower unelected bureaucrats to all but outlaw America's most abundant sources of energy. After banning its use in America, I'd make it illegal for American companies to ship it overseas. If I wanted America to fail, I'd use their schools to teach one generation of Americans that their factories and their cars will cause a new ice age. And I'd muster a straight face so I could teach the next generation that they're causing global warming. When it's cold out, I'd call it climate change instead. I'd imply that America's cities and factories could run on wind power and wishes. I'd teach children how to ignore the hypocrisy of condemning logging, mining, and farming while having roofs over their heads, heat in their homes, and food on their tables. I would never teach children that the free market is the only force in human history to uplift the poor, establish the middle class, and create lasting prosperity. Instead, I'd demonize prosperity itself so that they will not miss what they will never have. If I wanted America to fail, I would create countless new regulations and seldom cancel old ones that would be so complicated that only bureaucrats, lawyers, and lobbyists could understand them. That way, small businesses with big ideas wouldn't stand a chance. And I would never have to worry about another Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, or Steve Jobs. I would ridicule as flat earthers those who urge them to lower energy costs by increasing supply. And when the evangelists of common sense try to remind people about the laws of supply and demand, I'd enlist the sympathetic media to drown them out. If I wanted America to fail, I would empower unaccountable bureaucracy seated in a distant capital to bully Americans out of their dreams and their property rights. I'd send federal agents to raid guitar factories for using the wrong kind of wood. I'd force homeowners to tear down their own homes built on their own land. I'd make it almost impossible for farmers to farm, miners to mine, loggers to log, and builders to build. Because I don't believe in free markets, I'd invent false ones. I'd devise fictitious products like carbon credits and trade them in imaginary markets. I'd convince people that this would create jobs and be good for the economy. If I wanted America to fail, for every concern, I'd invent a crisis, and for every crisis, I'd invent the cause, like shutting down entire industries and killing tens of thousands of jobs in the name of saving spotted owls. And when everyone learned the stunning irony that the owls were victims of their larger cousins and not people, it would already be decades too late. If I wanted America to fail, I'd make it easier to stop commerce than to start it, easier to kill jobs than create them, more fashionable to resent success than to seek it. When industries seek to create jobs, I'd file lawsuits to stop them, and then I'd make taxpayers pay for my lawyers. If I wanted America to fail, I would transform the environmental agenda from a document of conservation to an economic suicide pact. I would concede entire industries to our economic rivals by imposing regulations that cost trillions. I would celebrate those who preach environmental austerity in public while indulging a lavish lifestyle in private. I convince Americans that Europe has it right and that America has it wrong. If I wanted America to fail, I would prey on the goodness and the decency of ordinary Americans. I would only need to convince them that all of this is for the greater good. If I wanted America to fail, I suppose I wouldn't change a thing.